Thank you. We're starting a little bit late. I'm going to try and compress what I have to say to try and get us back on schedule. And in that context, I hope I'll be forgiven for merely echoing and repeating what all the other speakers have had to say about the organizers and sponsors of what I think has been an extraordinarily impressive seminar up to this point. In my paper in the book, I argued that a new defense in defamation that has emerged in the, I suppose one might call it the Commonwealth world, called responsible or reasonable publication, amounts in reality to the reintroduction of a requirement of fault for defamation. And I should perhaps pause here just for a second and explain what I mean by fault. Mostly, you will know that if somebody sues for damages arising out of a car accident, they won't be successful unless the driver of the car has been negligent. In fact, it's very difficult to think in most jurisdictions of how one could ever get damages from another party in the absence of negligence. I'm not talking here about where you actually intend to cause harm. That's dealt with differently. But in most jurisdictions, in most legal systems, it's considered to be a civilized constraint on damages that you only become liable if you have acted with some fault, in other words, carelessly or negligently. But that doesn't operate, or until recently, didn't operate for defamation. Defamation was very atypical, very odd and unusual tort, if you like, in English law, delict in Roman Dutch law, very atypical because in defamation, everything was presumed against the defendant. The plaintiff or the claimant would commence an action and there would be a presumption of his good reputation, his or her good reputation. There would be a presumption of the falsity of what had been written about him or her. There was a presumption about the damages that were going to be awarded, and there was also a presumption of fault. He was presumed to have been at fault, to have acted carelessly or negligently. And indeed, for many years, it has been recognized, of course, that this loads the dice too heavily in favor of a claimant or a plaintiff, and they can use the law of defamation to chill, as we say, or restrict comment, information, allegations, and criticism. And of course, in many jurisdictions, they have done precisely that. And it was in exactly that context that the United States Supreme Court, in their very turbulent 1960s, took another look at the conventional defamation action and decided that things had to change. They, of course, had the advantage that fault was very much a requirement of a defamation action in certain states. So, for example, in Kansas, there was no liability if publication had been made in good faith. In other words, if there had been no carelessness. Now, the case that went before the United States Supreme Court was the case of the New York Times and Sullivan. New York Times had published an advertisement signed by a number of well-known people criticizing the conduct of various senior police officers in the southern states in the context of the civil rights struggle. Sullivan was one of those police officials, and Sullivan sued the New York Times for defamation. Now, the judgment doesn't mention it, but the history books do. Had Sullivan won and retained the damages that a southern jury awarded him, the New York Times probably would have been out of business. It's the end of it. And the US Supreme Court was anxious to avoid that kind of result because, of course, if Sullivan had won and put the New York Times out of business, any other liberal newspaper in the United States would similarly, in due course, have been put out of business. So they formulated a new rule. They said that no liability for defamation could lie unless you could prove that the newspaper knew of the falsity of what it had printed. Of course, that's very difficult to do. as an alternative, they said also if you could prove that the newspaper acted with reckless disregard for the truth or falsity of its allegations, then, and only in those two circumstances, could you recover damages. And of course, that had the effect of massively restricting the ability of plaintiffs or claimants to sue newspapers, because it really is very difficult to prove that the newspaper or the editor actually had concrete knowledge that what he had printed was false, apart, of course, from the fact that it's generally pretty unlikely, because most editors try and avoid that. Later on, the US Supreme Court extended that protection. Sullivan, of course, applied only to public officials. Sullivan himself, as I say, was a senior police official. But the protection was extended also to defamation of private parties. But the interesting thing here is that it was a different protection. Whereas with public officials, a plaintiff would be required to show actual knowledge of falsity. Dealing with private individuals, they merely needed to show that the newspaper had been negligent. Now, I'm not a particular fan of the distinction that the American courts make between private and public individuals. I am sure that in the two jurisdictions that I mainly work in, South Africa and the United Kingdom, the preliminary skirmishes on this issue would be so long, so complicated, and so expensive that that would in itself act to chill the free flow of information. So it's a distinction I think is probably unnecessary, and I don't like it. I think there's also a rule of law issue here as well. I'm slightly failed to understand how one person is required to clear a 6-foot bar in the high jump in order to win a defamation case, and another person is only required to clear a 3-foot bar. I do think there's a rule of law issue there. It's never been tested, but it's another reason why I don't like that particular distinction. But what I think we can take from the American jurisprudence in Sullivan and the succeeding cases is the extraordinarily valuable insight that fault ought to be an element of defamation law. The United States seems to have achieved a very fair rebalancing of freedom of speech and the right to dignity through imposing a requirement of fault of some degree, because the courts there have not found it necessary to embark on any further radical reform. And so probably what we have there by the late 1960s, Sullivan was decided in 1964, what we have by the late 1960s is an accepted position in the US that fault had to be a requirement of any defamation action, just like it was required to be a requirement of any other tort or delict. Now, you might think that the English courts and the Commonwealth courts and the European courts would look at this and embark on the same process, or at least consider why not to. But for many, many years, they didn't. Sullivan remained in splendid isolation, so we were told, merely a product of the US Constitution, an instrument which you did not find anywhere else in the world. Of course, things changed. Bills of rights, constitutional rights, statutory protections of human rights became quite commonplace. It still, though, took 30 years for the courts of the Commonwealth, the UK, and Europe to start to reassess defamation law in the light of what Sullivan had done. Now, the earliest case in the UK was a case involving former Irish Taoiseach, Mr. Reynolds. And without going into any detail in that case, I want to read to you what the House of Lords said ought to be the basis of liability. House of Lords found that you could have a defense, or introduced a new defense, of reasonable publication. But it said, in order to ascertain whether or not the conditions were present for that, you had to take account of a list of roughly 10 items. I'm not going to read them all, but some of them are these. The seriousness of the allegation. The reason for that is the more serious the charge, the more the public is misinformed. Then the nature of the information, the extent to which the subject matter is a matter of public concern. In other words, if it's trivial, you might be in trouble. But if it's important, for example, I think Reynolds was facing allegations of corruption, well, that's got to come out. Then very significantly, the source of the information. And the next one, the steps taken to verify the information. Now that's critical, because for the first time, a UK court was making it important for the newspaper's conduct to come under scrutiny. The newspaper's conduct now was going to shape and determine whether or not it was held liable. And then there are various other issues of which the tone of the article, in other words, is it unnecessarily insulting, was important, and the circumstances of publication. I'm going to come back to that decision, but it was a very early UK decision, and in my view, actually, in fact, the high point of the UK jurisprudence in this issue. What followed, I'm afraid, were some rather tortured formulations in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and the UK. I don't want to rehearse them here because it's a tedious and ultimately unrewarding exercise. I simply want to say that all of them required the newspaper to have done some investigation to establish the truth of what was written. And it is irrelevant, I think, in my view, that these cases after Reynolds sought to achieve this result, first of all by piggybacking on the old qualified privilege defence, which I would have thought was obviously inappropriate, and secondly, elevating public interest simply from the requirement that the information be important and be something that the public needs to know in order to exercise a vote or a choice or form an opinion, and putting public interest, not fault, at the centre of the defence. I think that's where they've gone wrong. The UK now, of course, has baked in some of those flaws, in my view, into the Defamation Act. Difficult to see how they can get them out now. So the UK will probably proceed on its own particular path. But I want to leapfrog all of these decisions and jurisdictions and go straight to Canada. The reason for doing that is that the Canadian, or rather the Supreme Court of Canada, had the benefit of being the last major appeal court in the Commonwealth to address this issue. So they had the advantage of the reasoning of the courts of New Zealand and Australia and South Africa and the UK, a couple of big cases in the UK. And they came up with what I think is a simple formulation and a very good one. And it's this. The old regime of strict liability is out. So the idea that you can have a tort of defamation where without the requirement of fault, gone. The new defence, rightly in my view, they said, did not arise out of qualified privilege. And then they come to describe the new defence, and it consists of two arms, really. The first is that the information published must have been in the public interest. Well, that's always been the case, and that's quite uncontentious. In other words, it must have had some importance and some relevance to public life. The second, they recount the steps that they think should be taken by the newspaper and the kind of information that they think should be protected. So they say you must consider the seriousness of the allegations, their public importance, their urgency, the status and reliability of the source. I think that again goes back to whether the journalist has been taken in by an untrustworthy source or whether he's checked things out and has corroborated his source. You must, of course, report the claimant's version. It mustn't be a one-sided report. And the inclusion of the defamatory statement complained of must be necessary in the article. You can't gratuitously throw in defamatory remarks. Slightly more contentiously, they say, also look at the defendant's intended meaning. I'll come back to that in a minute or two. And so you will see immediately that this is very consistent with the requirements in Reynolds, with perhaps one important distinction, and that is Reynolds explicitly said, we want to have a look at your verification exercise and see if that has been sufficiently thorough. Canadian court didn't explicitly say that. I think that it is implied, though, in their requirement that the source be reliable, because how can the source be reliable unless you have investigated the allegations? I want to briefly, to sum up on this, just read you another quote. It's from a legal historian called Eric de Schiemaker, who's French and I think teaches currently at Edinburgh University. And I want to read you what he says about Reynolds. And as an outsider, as somebody schooled in French law, how he interprets Reynolds. He says, structurally, the interest of the Reynolds defense is that it is entirely fault-shaped. The defendant is prima facie liable, but will be absolved from liability if he proves that he has been responsible. This responsibleness is, similarly to cases of qualified privilege, ousted by malice, but here it is extremely difficult to see how a defendant who could avail himself of a defense defined in terms of reasonableness or lack of carelessness could then be shown to have been malicious. The standard of liability is strict, but is defeated by a culpa-shaped defense. Culpa is Latin word meaning negligence. As a result, apart from the onus of proof, publications coming within the scope of the Reynolds defense are now subject to an almost pure negligence claim, which he describes as this. You owed me a duty not to carelessly defame me, and you have breached your duty by irresponsibly publishing defamatory material, thereby injuring my reputation. And I have to say, I have never seen anything that improves on that particular formulation. I think then that it's time for the Commonwealth courts, all of them, to accept that what they have done by reintroducing the newspapers or the defendant's conduct into an assessment of whether or not the publication is reasonable. I think that they should simply accept that they have reintroduced the notion of fault, the concept of fault, and they should accept that defamation should now fall into the general negligence-based torts or delicts of our law. I want to leave you in the remaining 2 minutes, it looks to me, that I have, with three problems that arise, I think, out of this. One is the question of meaning. Now, in English law, by which I mean to include all Commonwealth law, meanings now exist at three levels. First, X stole the diamond. That's pretty uncompromising. If you say that, you've got to prove that he stole the diamond. The second is X is suspected on reasonable grounds of stealing the diamond. That's the level two meaning. And if you say that, then you must prove not that he stole the diamond, but the grounds that you have for thinking that he did. And they must be reasonable. And the third, the level three meaning, is that there are reasonable grounds to justify an investigation into whether or not X stole the diamond, which case, of course, you've got to prove grounds for investigation. Each of them requires a lesser level of proof. Now, the question is, if a newspaper publishes a level one meaning, in other words, X stole the diamond, but really intended to publish a level two meaning, that there were reasonable grounds to suspect X of stealing the diamond, and is not shown to have been negligent, does it escape liability? Remember, the Canadian case made reference to the intended meaning of the newspaper. I'm not myself entirely sure of the answer. I think it's problematic. The second issue that arises out of this is what happens when publication is accidental, but not negligent. In other words, you're a journalist, you've written a story, you finish it on the train, you fall asleep, the train gets to the destination, you get up in a rush, you collect all your belongings, and this piece of paper flutters out of your bag, back onto the seat is picked up and published somewhere else. Again, I would have some difficulty because I think that negligence in this context really means verification of the story. I'm not sure that it relates to accidental publication, but I think it is a problem, and I don't think that the answer is in any way clear-cut. The last problem that I want to leave you with, at precisely no minutes and no seconds to go, is by far the biggest, and that is it right that a plaintiff or a claimant be denied trial on the truth of what has been said about him? Because, of course, if he sues for defamation and the newspaper simply pleads responsible publication, I may or may not have been correct, but at least I researched the position and tried to be correct, then the case will be decided on the newspaper's negligence, and nobody will ever know whether or not the plaintiff actually did or didn't do what he was said to have done. And it's for that reason that I say that he is now denied a trial on truth. Is that right? Again, I think it is a complicated question. My own personal feeling is tough luck. That's just the way it goes. Law's not perfect. But there may well be other viewpoints out there. Thank you very much.